Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3080 et al. United States of America Appellant versus Anthony Thomas. Ms. Nyland for the appellant, Mr. Kramer for the appellee.
Good morning. Suzanne Nyland for the United States. We are here this morning asking the court to vacate Mr. Thomas's sentence and send it to the district court for resentencing under the Armed Career Criminal Act on two grounds. One, that the district court was procedurally barred from revisiting the ACC determination when the case was remanded after first appeal pursuant to Booker. And second, that even on the merits, if the district court had been empowered to reach them, which it wasn't, under the established case law in this circuit and under still prevailing case law from the Supreme Court, the district court erred by entertaining the argument that the government was obliged to bring in the indictments when it hadn't really raised a real dispute to the factual accuracy of the PSR, and even accepting that the government was obliged to bring in the indictments on the prior offenses. The district court erred by not relying on them and simply determining that these were the dates of offense in order to then determine did they count separately as ACC predicates. On the first point in the procedural bar, it is our view that the law of the case prohibited the district court from revisiting the ACC determination because when the case came up here in the first appeal, Mr. Thomas's ACCA sentence was not appealed in any way. The court was never alerted to the arguments that were made on remand subsequently along the lines of what kind of documentation the government had to bring in, if any, to support its ACCA request. And by essentially forfeiting that claim and not raising it up here, and by indeed not even raising the exact same ACCA challenges as in the first sentencing that they're now raising, Mr. Thomas was barred by raising it in response to the Booker remand. Now, he's argued that the Booker remand somehow empowered the district court to revisit the ACCA question. We dispute that because the Booker remand was given by this court, ordered by this court, in response to Mr. Thomas's request to have the case sent back because Booker had been decided and he wanted to be sentenced under the advisory guideline regime as opposed to the mandatory one. He did not come into the court and say, we want to challenge our ACCA sentence. We want to challenge, even if one could procedurally do so, he didn't even say this, we want to challenge whether Almendarez-Torres and the Apprendi exception for prior convictions is still good law in light of Shepard or Booker.
Shepard that would be encompassed by a Booker, arguably, by a Booker remand, right?
That would not be encompassed.
Challenging the continuing validity of Almendarez-Torres be encompassed by a Booker remand given the uncertainty created by Booker? I realize that doesn't get them all the way, but...
Well, I suppose that would be termed a constitutional Booker error allegation. And I would state in this case that it doesn't get them all the way because they never made that claim in their initial brief. And in the reply brief, which is not the place to raise new claims, they couldn't raise that claim in the first instance. And when the court remanded the case pursuant to Booker, it gave no signal to the district court that the door was open to revisit the ACCA sentence and consider his allegedly Shepard-based arguments. And I say allegedly because it's our position that Shepard didn't change the law in this area, and that Booker didn't change the law in this area of the sentencing court's continued authority to make sentencing determinations based on prior convictions without having to go through the exercise of stating or finding whether a jury made the particular findings or a defendant made the particular findings upon which the court's sentence is based.
Did you agree to the Booker? Remember when the panel on rehearing said we're changing it from Coles to Booker? Did the government agree with that?
The government did agree with that, and the way this unfolded was Mr. Thomas, in his initial brief, made the argument that he wanted resentencing under the advisory guidelines. The government, in its responsive brief, said, we agree with that. Based on this record, we don't think this should be a Coles remand because we think the record's clear enough that the district judge would prefer to examine this under an advisory regime. But the government said, sort of sent up the flare that we don't think this will affect the ACCA sentence. That's a separate statutory basis and pretty much almost the entire legs on which this particular sentence rested, more so than the guidelines. And in response to that, for the first time, Thomas came back in his reply brief and said, well, without referencing, I believe, even the ACCA sentence, said...
Didn't it reference Shepard?
It did reference Shepard, which had been decided, in fairness to Mr. Thomas, between his initial brief and the reply. And he said, I would like to, based on Justice Thomas's concurrence in Shepard, ask the district court to reconsider and then make a record as to whether or not Almendarez-Torres and the Apprendi exception are still good law in light of Booker. That hadn't been fully briefed or placed before this court. And Mr. Thomas didn't highlight for the court all the permutations of the argument that he then made in the district court, which are rather new, regarding whether or not Shepard requires the government in the first instance to bring in indictments, for instance, in a case like this to establish dates of offense, where the defendant has not, as this court requires in Pinnock and has reaffirmed in Price, actually come in and raise a real factual dispute as to the accuracy of what's reported in the pre-sentence report.
Do you agree that PSRs aren't good enough after Shepard?
I do not. I think that this court's, first of all, I disagree that Shepard stands for that proposition, since Shepard himself had not raised that issue. It wasn't part of the procedural background in that case. I don't know how it can stand for that proposition, but this court has not yet overruled, reexamined what it said in Pinnock and reaffirmed in Price, which is a post-Shepard decision, along the lines that it's not...
Reference Shepard, though, right?
It didn't reference Shepard. It did not. That's true. And I don't know that that issue... In fact, I don't think that issue was teed up particularly in that case, of course, but it still remains good law.
But in any event, you don't need the PSR here, right?
Indeed, we don't. You know, to sort of cut to the bottom line on this and even assume that there isn't a procedural bar to this claim, which there is on many grounds, when the district court was produced with the indictments here, which established that for these two garden variety 1991 narcotics offenses in Superior Court in the District of Columbia, one was charged in April of 1991, the other in September 91. There's never been an assertion by Mr. Thomas that indeed these two offenses occurred at the same time and that it would be unfair to sentence him as a career criminal by counting these among his separate offenses. What he has simply said is, let's just keep raising the bar higher and higher and higher for the government to show that these are indeed separate offenses, to a point which doesn't raise any kind of dispute about factual accuracy, but which also challenges common sense. I have to make the very critical point here to us that the district court's finding that a jury must determine the date of offense is not realistically the way these cases are decided in Superior Court, or in my understanding, even here in the district court. We don't instruct the juries in either case to make a determination not only as to whether all the elements of a Puig cocaine offense have been established, but that the offense occurred on date X or a date certain. Therefore, if the district court's approach to this is endorsed and adopted by the court, it will largely gut the ACCA as it applies to all kinds of offenses, not drug offenses, anytime there's been a jury trial, because juries just aren't asked to decide to nail that date down with that kind of specificity.
Well, it will be it'll be a matter of fortuity whether the government can establish the occasion, the date, not necessarily a matter of date, looking at the For Fourth Circuit, for instance, burglaries, done on the same day, burglaries of different homes, are separate occasions. Right?
That's correct. It does kind of boil down to the individual circumstances of what happens to be in the indictment on that point.
And there may be,
and whether it was a clear trial.
Even in cases less clear than that, there may be sufficient proof in the course of trial, because one occurred during hot weather and another during cold weather, that might come out. You're going to be combing around looking for something that proves that they're necessarily on different occasions when there's no systematic way of inventorying that fact.
Exactly, and I
right?
think
so that but what are we to do when Justice Souter's opinion says no possibility?
I don't think that applies to the date of conviction. I think that is an important distinction between the Shepard-Taylor line of cases, where the question is, what is the conviction?
Well, let's suppose in this case, we have a jury verdict on a PUID.
The jury verdict is on the distribution followed by the plea on the attempted quid.
Okay, so you've got a distribution conviction and an attempted quid. Now, there's no obvious or physical reason why those two charges couldn't arise from the same moment when the police encounter the defendant.
That's entirely possible.
If it's possible, that's the end of the matter as far as the wording in Shepard.
Why do you agree that's possible?
If someone's carrying the stash on his person, and it's very possible the government would argue
the contrary. I thought one of them was April.
Well, if we're assuming that, what I'm agreeing is it's conceivably possible. What I'm arguing is when the indictments are 5 months apart.
No, I understand. It makes it unlikely, maybe even unlikely in the extreme. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make it impossible.
But I don't think that much more difficult case is presented to the court here. If, for instance, we had indictments.
We have two offenses that could have occurred simultaneously. Right? It's not like one was a burglary in California and another in the district.
That's true, but they're also 5 months apart.
No, the indictments are 5 months apart.
They are, and the dates that are asserted, their indictments are several months apart, but the dates that are charged are 5 months apart.
The dates of the offenses are 5 months apart.
Right.
According to the charge.
Yeah.
And so there's no proof. The jury didn't make a special verdict on that.
That's true. The jury didn't make a special verdict on it, but Shepard and Taylor tell us as a practical matter, and they were based, at least Taylor, and I would argue Shepard still, based on a matter of statutory construction, giving the courts some kind of guidance as to how to review the paperwork associated with prior convictions to determine their character sufficient to decide whether they're ACC predicates. To take those cases, which were based in sort of a common sense line drawing of, you look at the statute. If the statute doesn't answer the question, you look at the indictment. If the indictment doesn't answer the question, you can drill down to the jury verdict or what the defendant said is plea colloquy. Here, the court need not drill down that far because the date of the offense in the indictment tells us that these offenses occurred at separate times.
Well, the indictment, in one instance, in the attempted possession, was it?
Yes.
That was pled down from a higher charge.
It was pled from the quid to the attempted quid. Mr. Thomas has not argued the attempted quid isn't on that basis still a qualifying offense. He's arguing strictly the dates.
No, not a qualifying offense. The point is that what the person pled to and what's in the indictment can be very different.
I don't know that I can agree with very different, but I will sort of pose this problem.
Suppose we have a plea bargaining and you're saying I want to charge you with a quid on December 1st, and I say I'll plead to an attempt on December 15th, for which there's evidence.
At some point, it may come down to where the government is required to or should be filing a different criminal information, a separate criminal information, if it's going to be that far apart. I think the problem here, though, is if the government's burden is to show by a preponderance of the evidence, which it is under Pinnock and Price, that these offenses occurred on different dates, and we've tendered indictments that show dates 5 months apart, and appellant has never so much as said these happened on the same day.
Well, so are you saying that this is interesting? So that one has to prove that it was not possible they were on the same date by preponderance of the evidence?
I would disagree with that.
Seems like a contradiction.
I think the government's burden is to simply show by a preponderance that they did occur at separate times, and I think the indictments suffice to show that.
Can't you also show it by reversing it and saying, here is why it could not have happened on the same day? If he was found guilty by a jury verdict of the distribution, and a court later had his guilty plea to attempted possession growing out of that, no district court would take that plea. I mean, he'd already been found guilty of distribution, and whether it's double jeopardy, whether it's the lesser included, I mean, if it were
the splitting of a claim,
it is impossible that it happened the same day and still make his later plea valid.
And the other practical problem, depending on how far down one looks into the record here, is that the second charge was picked up while Mr. Thomas was out of release from the first charge. What was he out on release for if it wasn't for a previous and separate offense? In any event, and I see that I'm past my time, and I wanted to reserve some time for rebuttal, but I would ask the court vacate and send the case back for resentencing under the ACCA, primarily because of the procedural bars, but also because I don't know what's left of the ACCA if the court can't reasonably rely on indictments with dates 5 months apart where there's no serious factual dispute that they happened at the same time.
Are we touching on Fourth Amendment issues on your next round, I guess?
Well, I was wondering. I wasn't entirely sure.
Why don't we wait until your rebuttal and I'll ask one on that?
That would be helpful. Thank you.
I do have one more question on the Booker. When I asked you, did you agree to the Booker, and you said, but we made plain that this wasn't going to affect the career offender, what did you think? It seems to me that her hands would have been tied by the ACCA. What did you think she could do, even in view of the language about this is a harsh result, and that's why the panel sent it back for Booker?
His sentence was 188 months, which was 8 months above the 180 minimum from the 15 years. So it would have only been really the effect of fighting back those last 8 months.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The district court in this case had an unusual opportunity to get the case right the second time around and sentence correctly, and the district court took that opportunity and did sentence Mr. Thomas correctly. The government cites no case saying that the district court, when it decides to reconsider an issue that it thought was properly before it, that the district court abuses its discretion when it considers that issue. The government, and I cited several cases saying that the district court does have that discretion. The government cites no case where this court has reversed, this court or any other court of appeals, has reversed a district court for reconsidering a sentencing issue that the district court determined was properly before it. So that
I say about Wren. Wren seems to be over on the side by itself. Is that what's your position on why this isn't affected by Wren?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. I think McCoy, subsequent to Wren, the en banc decision in McCoy said the Rule 32 for any good or reason or fair reason. And there's also the district court found a couple of things. It found that it would be an injustice to sentence Mr. Thomas improperly, and I cited a couple of cases talking about that to reconsider a sentence. The district court also found that Shepard changed the law, that there was a change in the controlling law, and I think it's clear that Shepard did. Pardon me?
That takes it out of Wren.
That takes it out of Wren and McCoy and every case the government intends precludes the resentencing. And it's clear that Shepard did change the law in this circuit and the country. This circuit said just recently in an NRA sealed case that if to the extent Hill could be read to authorize inquiry into certain things, Shepard has superseded it, essentially said that what Hill and Richardson said was wrong. So the district court was also correct in deciding that there was a change in the controlling law in this case and it could reconsider the decision. Having decided properly that it could reconsider the decision, the district court did make one error, and I rely upon Judge Wilkins's dissent in the Thompson case in the Fourth Circuit, saying that this is a fact about a prior conviction, not of a prior conviction, that goes beyond what a court can do at a subsequent sentencing. And just as Judge Wilkins sets it out in quite detail, and just recently after Thompson in James versus United States, the Supreme Court was careful to say in another ARCA case that we, in applying this categorical approach, we have avoided any inquiry into the underlying facts of the offense. That would be prohibited by the Sixth Amendment.
So and Taylor contemplate just some inquiry into the underlying facts?
Only to the extent that the jury, and the key word I think that the government ignores in their argument in their brief, only for cases that went to trial that the jury necessarily found or that the defendant necessarily admitted in plea cases. Those are the crucial words of Shepard. And in an In Re Sealed case, that's what the court took those words from Shepard.
But in the universe of things you can look at, it includes the charging documents.
You can look at the charging document to see if it's a categorical crime of violence. When you get to something like a date, that's a whole different thing, whether the defendant necessarily admitted that or and I think that's why it goes to Judge Wilkins' dissent of you're talking now about a fact of the offense.
What about the problem that the date's often not in the jury verdict?
Well, that was not an argument made to the district court by the government. The district court started its argument to the government saying this was a cold
remand. Just in terms of the implications of the rule you're seeking here, that's a big potential issue, and that would, as the government suggests, got use of prior convictions in many cases.
Well, first of all, they could produce the jury instructions and see if the jury was instructed that it had to be on that date. There are some crimes, I think, that have to be proved on a specific date because of proof problems if it's a different date. I'm not sure that's correct. It's not in the record to the district. It's not in the record to
suppose,
this.
Suppose there's wire fraud, and the allegation is that on January 1, the defendant did such and such. And there's no proof that would support anything other than January 1. There's a transcript of a telephone call. Wouldn't that be sufficient?
I'm not sure I understand.
You get a guilty verdict. There's no special verdict that it occurred on January 1. The allegation and all of the proof relate to January 1. It would have been impossible to find that this occurred on any other date. There's just no evidence whatsoever.
That's a different question, though, than whether that offense can be used to enhance a sentence later on. That verdict may stand because the jury's usually the jury's.
Of course, the verdict will stand. The question is whether that can't be determined later that was a separate occasion from some other offense that occurred on January 15th.
And the simple answer under Shepherd is no, unless the government proves that the jury necessarily found that fact. That's Shepherd takes care of that. Justice Thomas would have gone farther in Shepherd and said this: none of these things
so
can
even
be proved.
If the only date date for which there was any evidence was January 1, the jury didn't necessarily find that it occurred on January 1.
If you produced jury instructions that said...
No, that doesn't happen.
Then I think the answer is no.
Might happen after this decision. Who knows?
I think the answer is no. The Shepherd was clear, and this court in In Re Sealed Case was clear. It's not what probably happened or maybe happened or even a good chance happened.
How about beyond a reasonable doubt?
Pardon me?
Beyond a reasonable doubt happened.
Well, it's not even that.
I realize
it's
what that's not usually a standard we apply to this kind of circumstance, but suppose...
It's not the standard of proof as much as it is that it's necessary. It has to be necessarily found or necessarily admitted.
But see, it's very hard. That's what I was talking with Ms. Nyland about. If you say that you have to find only by a preponderance that it was impossible, it's essentially the same as...
Well, two things, I guess. In Shepherd, you got to remember, it's Shepherd. The defendant did not dispute any of the facts, the underlying facts. He just said that at the...
Do we have a dispute here?
Yeah, well...
Aren't you just trying to raise the bar, as Ms. Nyland said?
Well, the dispute is that the information in the pre-sentence report, which solely relied upon police reports, the two dates, it said according to the police report, the date for each of these, and according to the police report. And the argument to the...
Wait a minute. We have the indictments, though, right? Yeah.
The indictments show that, but there's nothing to show that that was necessarily admitted by the defendant or necessarily found by the jury. That's what Shepherd's all about.
Right. I guess it depends on necessary.
Well, let me. It's easier.
You're indicted for something that occurred on September 18, 1991, and then you plead guilty. That was to the PUID, and then you plead guilty to the attempted PUID.
Well,
isn't it necessary that the offense that you're pleading guilty to occurred on September 18, 1991?
No, not at all. It could be. First of all, it's on or about. And juries instructed on or about means sometime reasonably near the time. There's cases out there holding many months is reasonable, but the government made no argument about this on or about language. And especially with respect to the plea, there's no indication of what the plea was to, whether it was to this. To answer Judge Henderson's question about the impossibility, he may have pled. We don't know. The government could have produced the plea transcript, could have produced the jury instructions, could have produced a statement of facts. With respect to the district court conviction from Virginia, they did, but it could have not been impossible.
Taking your point that it could be on or about September 18th, 1991, and then the other one is on or about April 17th, 1991, even if you give a little leeway there and there could be close cases in other situations, it's not really plausible.
But
think the two occurred on the same date.
But the date may not even be necessary. That's the whole point of the Shepherd analysis. It's not necessary to the plea, and especially the plea to the lesser included. There's no indication of what he actually pleaded to, whether it was that particular lesser included of that or a lesser included on some other date. There's no date connected. And if one of these convictions is in can't be said to be on a different occasion. That takes care of it. So the one to which the guilty plea, and to answer Judge Henderson's question about the, that could have been. We don't know because they didn't produce any record. It just says plea to lesser included. That could have been. He could have been on that day that he was convicted of distribution. He may have started to hand drugs to somebody else standing right next to the person. That could have been the plea deal.
I mean, could have been.
Could have been. That's all you need under Shepherd, though.
I don't know.
What about the plea colloquy? Wouldn't that establish it?
It would, I think.
Doesn't it? I mean, if the judge properly conducted the colloquy, right, then he found that there was evidence to support the charge to which he was pleading.
And I think that
the charge included a date.
I think that that's often the way the government proves what it has to under Shepherd. And you got to remember, the district court continued this case 5 or 6 times to give the government a chance to produce the documents, every time telling the government what it needed to produce. And you're absolutely right. If there was a plea colloquy that said, how do you plead to lesser included offense attempted quit on June 7th, 19th, whatever the date was, that would cover it. Because
well, the judge doesn't have to regurgitate the date, right? He just has to determine that there's a factual basis for the plea. And even if there isn't any focus on the date, that determination is made if the plea is accepted.
Well, let me put it this. They produced the records of the assault conviction from the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia in this case. It had a, that's why that conviction is not challenged. That had a signed plea agreement and statement of facts that specifically had the date in it. They were given the chance to produce that in this case, and the simple answer to that is that's what Shepherd says is required. You have to have the plea, Shepherd specifically refers to the plea colloquy, the statement of facts, or something the defendant necessarily admitted when the defendant pleaded.
If it's a credit for pleading?
Well, he went to trial in this case.
And but there's one, we've got two cases here.
Two of the prior convictions, you mean?
Yeah.
The sentences were run concurrent when he was, okay. When he, but.
Sentenced together for these two, right?
Yes, yes.
All right, I have a bunch of questions, first of all. When you objected to the two separate occasions or three separate occasions or whatever, you said they should be considered as a single offense because they were separated by less than a year. You didn't say they happened on the same date. In the exact same area, on the exact same block, involved the same drug, and the same societal victim. Now, why aren't you stuck with that?
Well,
that they're separated by less than a year does not say they're on the same date.
But it said, well, it, first of all, it doesn't preclude that. But second of all, it says according to the pre-sentence report, according to the information in the pre-sentence report. That was the at this original sentencing and the district, let me put it this way, the district court found that was not an admission. And a matter of fact, if you go the next couple of pages, then the government and the district court start talking about whether that means they were committed on different occasions or not. So they clearly understood.
I'm talking about the first sentencing.
It's page 143
of yours?
My appendix, yes.
143, yeah.
It goes on to 144 and 145. The lawyer said that according to the pre-sentence report, but the argument made, wasn't an admission. It said according to the pre-sentence report. And the argument to judge, which Judge Collier accepted, and again, the government cites no case saying it's an abuse of discretion. Judge Collier said, well, I find that was sufficient to preserve the issue for me to reconsider now. And now I understand the objection is that the information in the pre-sentence report, so later on, when the argument is that the pre-sentence report is not good enough under Shepherd, which In re Sealed Case says is exactly right, the pre-sentence report is not good enough, especially if you raise the issue that it's not good enough. That was not an admission. It just said according to the pre-sentence report says this.
Okay. Let me ask you, on page 47 of the government's appendix, and I had some trouble figuring this out. Is this not the indictment, the one-count indictment for September, followed by, on page 48, the waiver of trial by jury, that is the plea, followed by the judgment and commitment in which he pled guilty to attempted possession with intent to distribute.
Yes.
That is the one that fits what he pled guilty to after having been convicted of distribution on what he now claims, and I don't know whether he claimed it when he pled, the very same day, the very same drugs that he had been convicted of distributing.
Well, I'm sorry. He could have, let me give you a scenario where it could have been. You're right. These are the, it's in order. The first one.
I thought you said we don't know. I mean, we do know this is the indictment.
Yes.
And we do know that this is the waiver of jury trial. And we do know that this is the judgment and commitment.
Yes.
Order that matches that September 91. What we don't know is if September 91 is correct. But it certainly cannot be April of 91 because he already was convicted of distributing on that very same date. I mean,
I have two answers to that. Right. First of all, it could be, and second of all, even if it probably was not, Shepard says that's not good enough, as does In Re Sealed Case. It could be. He may have reached a plea agreement and said that on the day I was convicted, the offense I was convicted of,
distribution,
that same day, two people were standing in front of me. I sold to him. I was handing it to him, and the police arrested me. So I want to make a plea deal, and I'll plead to the attempted distribution to this other person. Is that likely? Probably not. Is it possible? Yes. That's all that's required under Shepard.
If Almendar, go ahead.
But let me ask you about this Thompson decision from the Fourth Circuit, because you've been talking about Judge Wilkins' dissent. And Judge Wilkinson, in the majority, makes a pretty powerful defense of using common sense and how we can't just say, well, all we can look at is the fact of the conviction and that's all. Anything that's inherent in that conviction, we can also consider. And that requires, in this case, I think looking at it from the point of view, could it have been on the same date? Could it have been on the same date? And you consider that at the time you objected, you said they were separated by less than a year. That is not the same date. And the fact that he's convicted of distributing on one date and then however long it was afterwards that he then pleads guilty to attempted possession to distribute on that very same date, that doesn't seem like...
But in Thompson, as I recall, the defendant had admitted that he had these separate convictions on separate dates. That's what I was trying to find that.
I don't see how the court could have been divided in that case.
Judge Wilkins said a district court can't find that a finding of the date that they were committed on different occasions is a finding about the prior convictions, not a finding of the prior convictions.
If he admitted it, though, there isn't an issue.
But he said that even if he admitted it, the district court can't make that
finding. The jury has to make the finding, right?
That it either, yes, that, okay. Yes.
Can, if
so
this,
you say he wasn't taking the defendant's word for it.
Judge Wilkins said it's both a Fifth and Sixth Amendment violation for the district court to make this finding. Judge Wilkinson said, I don't think he said you use common sense. He said we have to follow Shepard, but if the documents are there to support the Shepard finding, Shepard may not be common sense. The court in Shepard said, the dissent in Shepard said, this isn't common sense. The defendant never contested that they were committed.
But how do we choose between common sense and the Supreme Court? We go with the Supreme Court. It's happened before.
Let me ask you a question.
That's not so often I argue that, but I think that's true.
If Almendarez Torres were overturned, right?
Yes.
And these kinds of facts had to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury, wouldn't the question here to the jury have been, do you find beyond a reasonable doubt that the offenses occurred on different occasions?
Yes, but I
okay.
that would be the ultimate.
That would be the question, right, to the jury, and that would satisfy all your arguments about Almendarez Torres, about the Thompson dissent. That's the ultimate procedure, and maybe that might happen someday.
Yes.
But if that does happen, the question will be that. So why shouldn't the same standard be applicable to what the judge is finding right now? If the judge finds beyond a reasonable doubt that they happened on different occasions, that should be good enough, right?
Well, first of all, Judge Collier found the opposite. She found that I don't have proof even by a preponderance that they were committed on different occasions.
If the court finds beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think that because Almendez-Torres hasn't been overruled and Shepard is the law, that
What you're seeming to suggest, and this is what I'm probing, is that the Shepard standard is somehow more than beyond a reasonable doubt, so more than what the Almendez-Torres overruling scenario would be, and I don't see how that can be possible.
I think it's reasonable doubt at a different stage. It's reasonable doubt in the prior proceedings, and to find whether it was proved beyond a reasonable doubt in the prior proceedings, you have to say whether the jury had to necessarily...
No, but it would be in the current proceeding, the jury would be asked, do you find beyond a reasonable doubt, as you sit here today, that the offenses were committed on different occasions?
But I think that there would have to be some instruction about that, about the proof they could consider. And I think you would get a judgment of acquittal if they didn't produce the proper, either the plea colloquy or the jury instructions on the prior offense. I think the commands of Shepard of what kinds of documents you can look at would still apply for that. I don't think they could just say, or...
Well, suppose the defendant testifies, and he says they were on different dates, and the police testify, and they say, this all happened when I arrested him on the single date. The jury convicts, and they find, especially, that it occurred on the same date.
Well, I think they would have had to necessarily find then that they were committed on the
same... Doesn't have to be in the prior proceeding, though.
I think you're right, but I don't think it affects this case, because this case is governed by Shepard, is the bottom line. And well, you may be right, and I haven't thought that through enough to know what kinds of...
Well, you keep saying it's possible, and that's what I'm just trying to explore, of whether even when someone's convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, that doesn't mean beyond all doubt, right?
Right. It has to be reasonable doubt. And when I keep saying it's possible, I take that from both Shepard and In Re Sealed Case, both of which say possible or probable doesn't matter. It has to necessarily have been admitted or necessarily have been found by the jury in the prior proceedings. So that's why I think that when the instruction is given beyond a reasonable doubt, I think there will have to be some that they will have to find that it was necessarily admitted by the defendant in the prior, if it was a guilty plea, or necessarily found by a prior jury. I think the instructions won't be just as simple as do you find beyond a reasonable doubt, but there'll be these predicates about that they'll have to find. I don't think you can just instruct them in the, you have to define that for them.
Find beyond a reasonable doubt that the offenses necessarily occurred on different dates. That's an odd instruction.
No, I think there's instructions when somebody says possession of a firearm, it seems simple, but then there's this long instruction about constructive possession, actual. Do you find they were committed on different occasions different from one another, I guess? I have to define for you what occasions different from one another means. That means different dates or whatever it might be. And in determining that fact, you have to find that the jury, prior jury, or the prior plea necessarily found or necessarily admitted. I think you would the instruction would have to, could not be as simple as do you find that without defining the terms, and they would have to be defined, I think, in accord with Shepard. I don't think it would change the holding of Shepard in the sense of what's required to find that. I think it would change the fact finder of that in the subsequent proceeding.
So we have a mess here.
Well, let me put it this way. The district court didn't abuse its discretion in reconsidering. The district court gave the government 5 or 6 continuances, I think, to produce the proper documents. And the district court carefully reviewed everything and reviewed the pre-sentence report and said that's not sufficient, and came to the conclusion, and this court reviews that for abuse of discretion.
But then she changed her mind, and she changed her mind too late. So she went back to the original thing. But let me ask you this.
That's okay.
Let me ask you this. Would you, if you were representing this defendant at the plea, would you have said to the court, or would you have disputed that this plea did not pertain to September of 1991?
Well, I don't know what the plea agreement was. There could have been a plea agreement that this related to some other transaction. I have no idea what that plea agreement was. You reach plea agreements all the time that may not cover the offense the person was originally charged with. You may plead to a totally different offense on a totally different date as part of a plea agreement. But also, it was the...
All right, well, we don't know the plea agreement. We've got the indictment that says September of 91.
Right.
Let's just assume that that's what the trial judge had as well. Well, he did have that. And that the plea agreement said September of 91.
If the plea agreement said that and the defendant necessarily admitted that during the plea, then that takes care of it. The government could have shown that. But also, the judge didn't change her mind. What happened is there was this phone conference. She said, well, I think I got it wrong. But then we said, no, we addressed that whole thing. And... also, you already sentenced him. And then she issued a written opinion and said, I was wrong when I thought I was wrong, essentially.
I thought she said, I can look at these charging documents.
She did. And during that phone conversation, which is, I think, in the record, the government misleads you when they say that the only thing we said during that phone call was it was too late. We also said during that phone call that, Judge, we discussed this, all these matters, at all the prior proceedings.
Because the oral sentence?
The oral sentence, yeah. Right. We argued an alternative. We said, Judge, we've already discussed all these matters and you rule, and anyhow, it's too late. And then when she issued a written opinion, she said, well, you're right. I was wrong when I thought I was wrong. Now I looked at it again and discovered I'm right. And she was absolutely correct, and I would ask you to affirm.
I was going to ask on a different topic. So.
No, that's
on the Fourth Amendment issue, does Gantt give any life to your argument?
Does what?
Gantt.
Well, I mean, the Schimmel.
The way it describes Schimmel gives some life to your argument.
The Schimmel, but yes, it certainly gives rise to the Bowie, that they may re-examine Bowie. It was not.
It looks that way.
It was not argued in the either below or in the briefs either time. But although it was indirectly argued in the sense that Bowie, this court has extended Bowie way too far over the years. But the specific argument.
The description of Bowie only describes part two, not part one.
Yes. Let me put it this way. The Fourth Amendment issues, when the cert petition was filed from the direct conviction, I recognize that I've argued those and exhaustively, not just once, but in two different briefs. But when the cert petition was filed, the government said this is interlocutory, you have to go back for the resentencing first before you can come up on the Fourth Amendment issues. So I think that I don't mean to imply that I don't think the issues I've raised are meritorious, but they had to be raised again to preserve the cert petition. I also think they're correct, however, but I understand that they've been decided once.
But this time, your argument is that the errors were so egregious.
Well, I think that the district court took
ordinary errors.
The district court took the opportunity to get it right the second time. I guess this court could too, but.
Have you noticed, Mr. Kramer, that your red light is on?
Yes, I did, Your Honor. But I kept hearing questions, so.
I want to make sure that I've made clear one really critical point on this issue of whether it's possible that the subsequent plea might have been on about a defense on the same day the trial had been about. In order for us to have reached a plea agreement that set a date of this kind of difference, 5 months apart, we would have had to either have another indictment or another criminal information, or there would have had to have been some waiver of those things. And there's no indication here in the file that happened. I just want to make it clear while we're exploring.
I thought there was another indictment.
We have only the two indictments with 5 months apart. If the suggestion here, if we're exploring what's possible and whether it's possible that the second offense, the second conviction here was actually for the same date as the first offense, there's nothing in this file indicating that it is possible because that wouldn't procedurally happen without another indictment or at least without the filing of a criminal information. The government,
according
if it had
to
a plea.
Your office procedures or some law?
by, I believe it's by office procedures, and I think also by Rule 8.
But you haven't put anything
And by practice in Superior Court.
I don't think you've put anything in or argued that your business practices are such that this could not have been for the same date.
That's true. I haven't said that. I just wanted to make sure the rule that the record was clear on that because of the exploration of the discussion that perhaps this could have all been on the same day.
Is the judgment and commitment that matches the indictment, the September 91 indictment, does that, I can pull it out, but do you know whether it, I couldn't tell whether it alludes to the indictment?
It doesn't specifically. The only thing that tethers them together is the case number. Yeah. I mean, as a matter of reality, that's all it's going to be.
Where's the plea agreement?
The plea agreement we don't have in the file. We were not able to find the plea agreement. There was an appeal from the trial, actually, but we didn't have the trial transcript of that. There wasn't a transcript of the plea,
These events occurred on different occasions, would the plea agreement substantiate that, necessarily substantiate that?
I'm not sure if it's been entered into the court record. I don't know that would be accepted as a substitute for a plea colloquy. I suppose it could. I'm not sure if we're looking to Shepherd whether we can do that.
Where's the transcript of the plea colloquy?
If we had a transcript, which ordinarily we wouldn't if there's no appeal from the plea, and we don't have a transcript of this plea colloquy.
Is there a recording from which a transcript can be made?
1991, no, not at this point. We didn't bring these documents in because they don't exist in this case.
Right. That's the typical problem here.
Which
right?
is the typical problem.
Well, in the case
problem.
Of the plea agreement,
the plea agreement
would have had that
was extended at some point. But we don't have that, but we don't have the plea colloquy. And often, as counsel is probably pointing out behind me, in Superior Court, they're not always reduced to a writing in a simple garden variety case like this. Often it'll just be the prosecutor standing up and reading the facts into the record, and the defendant will just go through a Rule 11 colloquy, and we don't often have a full written plea agreement of the type you get more commonly in this courthouse. So there might not have been a plea agreement. I have to correct for that. We just don't know for sure. I want to make just before I conclude just a brief plea for the notion that we don't have to have an unfortunate conflict between common sense and Shepherd here. Shepherd and Taylor and even in resealed case from this court all speak to the question how much material the sentencing court can look at to determine the nature of the offense. None of them speak to the dates of offense. The extension of Shepherd, if you read Shepherd the way defendant does, which we do not, to the determination of simple dates of prior convictions is something no court has done yet and something which the Fourth Circuit, as Judge Henderson has alluded to, spoke of in terms of common sense, urging that the line between facts that are inherent in a conviction and facts that are about a conviction is a commonsensical one. There is a distinction, and the Fourth Circuit labored hard to explain it very clearly. I certainly can't improve on it. It's hard to articulate, but there's a difference between trying to determine whether we're treating all burglaries nationwide, no matter what the statutes look like, equally under the ACCA, and whether we're simply determining what the date of an offense was. And in this case, that's the only issue that's before the court. Is it unreasonable for the district court to rely on the indictments, which Shepherd says, read the way we read it, can be done, to determine the simple fact of those convictions, which is what was the date of the offense? The separate question, whether these offenses happened at the same time or whether they were part of the same occurrence or occasion, is really more typically a legal question we would argue would never put forward to a jury. But the
if Almendarez-Torres were overruled, it'd be put forward to a jury.
But Almendarez-Torres,
several of the justices think it should be overruled.
But they haven't, and that would be my
right,
closing
but it,
point
but
I have to rely
your
on.
Your point was that it would be illogical to think about it as a jury question, but it could be a jury question soon.
And it would be a strange jury question because is the question, what did it happen at the same time,
strange.
Or is it what did the juries which preceded us thought happened? That's really what you're trying to determine is what those original juries determined. I'm not sure how you see the distinction. I'm not sure how they would do that. But more importantly, the court has not overruled Almendarez-Torres. So this whole much of the scenario that was been previously discussed with Mr. Kramer and the sort of spinning out of what this might look like in the future, we're not sure, but we know that they've repeatedly had the opportunity to consider the prior conviction exception, and they've repeatedly said we're not going to overrule that.
Ms. Nyland, is there a limitation in either ACCA or in government policy on how far back you will go to pick up the three offenses?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I can do a supplemental letter if we need to.
We'll check ACCA. If there's something in the government's policy, I think I would like to know that.
All right. Are there not any further questions?
Oh, is Gantt problematic for your search here?
Not yet. They haven't yet reexamined what happens with the first part of Maryland v. Bowie.
You can see it coming, right?
Well, I'm not sure what we see coming in light of that decision. I have to train police officers in a matter of hours on it, so I don't know. Now Maryland v. Bowie on top of it.
Keep you busy for years.
Thank you, Ms. Nyland. Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Case is submitted.